Hi there. You're listening to Sample Space, a podcast about tools and ideas from the realm of machine learning that deserve some more attention. In this episode, we'll be talking to Marco Gorelli, and he's well known for a few things. He was a maintainer of Pandas for a bit, and right now he's been very active in the Polars ecosystem. It's because of his background in both of these ecosystems that he's been able to work on this new tool called Narwhals that allows you to write code as you would normally in Polars, but at the same time, you would also be able to support Pandas data frames instead. Very recently, the project has actually been taking off, but in an interesting way. Since Narwhals is not really a library that's meant for end users, it is a library that's really meant to be used by project maintainers at this point, which makes the project kind of unique. We talk about a lot of things in this podcast, including what it can be like to maintain critical infrastructure for data science, and the conversation becomes quite personal as well. I hope you'll really enjoy it. All right. Hi, Marco.
Hi, Vincent.
Hi. So we are going to be talking about this thing called Narwhals that you've been working on. It's a very interesting point in time to talk about that project. But it also feels that before we can get there, we should also maybe talk about your trajectory and how we kind of got here. Because you've been doing open source for a while, but I think there's been a period in your life where you were more of a practitioner. And then at some point, there came a point where you were not just a practitioner, but also a sort of supplier of this open source code. So in short, like, you were a data scientist before. Like, how did you get started with doing open source? What's the story there?
All right, what's my origin story? So hello, everybody. My name's Marco. I originally wanted to be a musician, but then realized I wasn't good enough to make a living out of that. So figured I should maybe study maths or something like that. So did maths, did a master's degree in maths and computer science. Thought I wanted to be a researcher, but then realized I wasn't good enough at that either. So decided to learn to code and became a data scientist.
And this, you consider doing a PhD like after your master's, or like you did one year of PhD and then, okay.
Well, I started a program which was like 1 year of master's by research that then would have become a PhD. So I finished the first year and then was like, yeah, this isn't really going anywhere. I'm not going to get any significant publications. I'm just not going to be able to climb the academic ladder. So,
and what field of math was this? Like, I did operations research, and I'm well aware of the fact that there are many subfields when it comes to math in that sense.
Yeah, this was on the applied maths side. So yeah, stochastic partial differential equations.
Ah, there you go. Like, those are words that are worth a lot of points in Scrabble. So that's always okay. But eventually you kind of think, okay, you should probably move a bit closer to industry. There's not a whole lot of partial differential math on whiteboards in industry. Better learn how to code a bit. So then when was this? Was like 10 years ago-ish, maybe a little bit of Python, like that era?
Something like that, 2016, 2017, that time. And yeah, coding kind of just clicked with me in the sense that I really just enjoyed it. Just thinking logically through things, the computer doing what you tell it to do. Like, it's quite a nice feeling.
And was Python your first entry into this realm? Because like some universities, they teach C and C++ and stuff. So then Python sometimes, I mean, it's taught everywhere nowadays, but back in those days, it wasn't necessarily being taught everywhere.
So when I say master's in maths and computer science, the computer science part was category theory, game theory, like, the programming part kind of.
Not a whole lot of simulation happening there, I guess.
The coding part came after. So yeah, started with R, but then quickly realized that all the recruiters who would call me up would ask if I knew Python. So I figured, okay, maybe I need to learn Python.
Gotcha. Okay. But and where were you, by the way? Was this, because you were, I think, in London for a bit, if I recall correct. Or I might have seen a talk of you in London, something like that. I forget. But like, where were you at this point?
So at this point, where was I living? I was living in Reading, which is not too far from London.
Right. No, but UK. And,
United Kingdom, yeah. Still in the United Kingdom, but now I live in Cardiff in Wales.
Gotcha. I can imagine, were you an independent? Because with London close by, there's plenty of jobs, right? So that is an easy gateway into the, hey, I know a fair bit of math. I can teach myself a bit of Python and data science is a thing. So like, you were in that era at that point in time, I suppose.
Yeah, I think we were still in a period when you didn't need to be too advanced to get a job in data science. So I kind of tried to ride that wave a bit and tried to teach myself a bit of Python, learn how to put the Jupyter notebook together and all that stuff. And yeah, landed a data science job. And yeah, I kind of liked the idea of open source. Like, I'd heard about it, this thing of people like collaborating on stuff and it being freely available to people. I just didn't really know how to get started. And people said, oh yeah, you should look for good first issues on GitHub and things. So I did that. I found that there was something on scikit-learn about just clarifying the degrees of freedom parameter in the standard scaler. So I just submitted a little fix for that. It got merged. Like, it was a really small thing, but I showed off about it for weeks. And
so made one change to the docs, and that gives you like a good bragging right for a month. That feeling. Yeah. No, I understand the feeling. I also remember my first PR.
I remember at EuroSciPy last year, like everyone was talking about, oh yeah, do you remember your first PR? People were bringing out stories. And it must have looked quite funny to outsiders.
My first PR was actually kind of insane. I worked on a little infrastructure script for Spark to make sure that when you had Spark R installed on an AWS cluster, that it would also come with RStudio. Like that was my first PR to open source. So like kind of doing infra things for fun there, but definitely useful because then I was a speaker at a lot of R conferences because of that.
You then became a meme because of your speaker gigs. So I'd say it paid off.
Yeah, I am a frequent speaker. That much is certainly true. But okay, I'm assuming at this point you were attending PyDatas as well, or conferences or meetups. Was that like a thing you were doing as well, or not as much?
Oh, not yet. No, I mean I made that little teeny tiny little pull request, but then I thought, okay, yeah, that was fun. Let's try to do something harder. And I realized I just didn't really have the chops to do it, so I gave up on open source for quite a while.
And when you say chops, would that include things like Git, or more like, oh man, I got to dive into the internals of this library? Like, chops can mean different things.
Yeah, debugging, just understanding things. Like, I was looking there at the code and seeing things like metaclass, and I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't have enough patience to learn what it meant. When I got back into open source was, I don't know, half a year later or something. I said quite a while.
Half a year is not that long. Yeah.
No, but I was younger at the time, so half a year comparatively felt like longer. Now time gallops, getting older.
Yeah, fair.
And just one day as part of my job, I was upgrading my dependencies. My Pandas broke one of my scripts, not because of a bug in Pandas, but because something that was undocumented stopped working. So, okay, technically it was my fault for using something undocumented, but it was fairly... it gave off a fairly mysterious error message. So I just reported this to them saying, well, maybe a good error message could help people. And they replied, yeah, sure. Do you want to submit a pull request? I was like, all right, going to get back into open source. Let's figure out how to do this.
Let's get the bragging right for this month in. Let's go. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And this one ended up being a little bit harder. Like, I had to follow paths around and put breakpoints and figure out where things were going. But I found the response is really friendly and really enjoyed the process.
And there's a fair bit of that in Pandas. I remember doing a code sprint where we have to add doc strings, and some of that stuff also, it's not always added to the method. Sometimes the doc string is automatically generated, and Pandas can be a bit of a deep dive.
Don't talk to me about Pandas doc strings. I hate that stuff. Like, to me, a doc string, like, even if you have to copy and paste the same doc string in a few different places, that's fine. Just put the doc string there where the function definition is, much simpler. And then you've got a bunch of linters and formatters that can automatically analyze it for you. Whereas if it's all this, I don't know, doc string substitution magic going on, then it's a mess.
Yeah, it's I recall it being slightly intimidating to get started with that sprint. But okay, But that this was your entry point into Pandas as well, because I hear a bit of passion when you talk about doc strings. So I'm assuming this was not your you went a bit deeper there and actually got to know the library for a bit, right? So the entry point was the error message, but from there, because the experience was kind of nice, people were friendly, I suppose that was also the motivation to keep going, right?
Exactly that, yeah. And yeah, you know, the moment you've made sense of the code around one particular method, you start noticing other things that look a bit strange, and you're like, ah, you know, maybe we should do this different, or this should be clearer, this code doesn't do anything. You know, you just start noticing things, and before you know it, you kind of become the go-to person that people ask about certain parts of the code base, and you then get addicted to it. This is a story I've heard from quite a few people getting into open source. It just starts at one step and it spirals out of control a bit.
So out of curiosity, like, what's the time frame here? So you came back to Pandas, you made that better error message, and then at some point you became one of the go-to people. Like, what kind of time span are we talking here?
It was about a year before I was added to the core team.
In a previous episode, I also talked to Adrian about this. Like, there is this addictive nature to open source where every time you add a new thing, you can kind of point at that and you can kind of look, everyone, millions of people are using this, my thing. And that, in a way, that's very motivating, but there's also a bit of a trap there where it kind of feels like there's always another issue. There's always another bug. You can always spend more time on open source just because the issue list is nearly endless. Was it also easy for you in that period to also take a step back? Because I can imagine it is a tricky relationship, right? With if you become one of the people that's core to a project, it also feels like you're carrying some responsibility.
Yeah, certainly. At the time, well, I really got involved heavily with contributing to open source during the COVID lockdowns. And certainly when the lockdown started to be lifted and I had less time, but it's not like the number of issues was decreasing, I did notice a bit of a difference, and it did become harder. I think you just need to somewhat decide that you don't care about certain things. Like, you can't assume responsibility for everything in a library. Yeah, as hard as it is, you need to say, like, this is my area of concern, and for anything else, I'm going to ping the relevant person and hope that it gets resolved.
Kind of in a give yourself permission not to do things kind of a way.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard.
I'm kind of curious because of the timing you mentioned there, like, because I can imagine, okay, COVID has started, okay, we're all indoors, and that can be like an excuse such that you end up doing a lot of PRs, and it might become your like mode of operation for a bit there. So I can see how that can kind of wiggle in, and I can also kind of see, well, everyone was suffering through COVID, there were some unhealthy habits we all did because we all had like cabin fever, I think, like something along those lines. But then I can imagine like life opens up again, and that then you are confronted with the fact that, oh, I'm spending so much time on this open source, and people are sort of like, was it the confrontation that you spent so much time on it, or the fact that you thought that people had expectations now because you were so involved?
What was hard for me was things that I'd started that hadn't quite finished, and I felt like, yeah, need to finish these, and still feel like that about some things. I mean, I remember just one day in particular, like, it was just such a nice day, really wanted to just go out and enjoy myself. And I did, but I also was like, there's this pretty urgent thing that I need to fix. And I ended up fixing it like, you know, the next day before starting work. But yeah, these kinds of things really started to weigh on me a lot more once the restrictions started to be lifted compared to before.
No, I can imagine. It's also one of those moments where, if anything, COVID was also a moment for people to reflect, I think. Like, hey, what do you actually spend your time on? What can and can you not control? And then fingers crossed, it's behind us. But hopefully a lot of us were able to reflect and actually be more considerate with our time now, I suppose. I do want to touch on this topic in a few moments as well. But we are talking now about a point in time where you were working on Pandas. And my impression is that at some point this pivoted a bit more towards Polars, or like, how did that kind of happen? Because I know you're quite involved with Polars nowadays.
Yeah, you are right. I think it was about a year and a half ago. I was hearing about this Polars and wanted to try using it. It was on a Saturday, so it wasn't even at work. I was just procrastinating on some life admin. I don't know, needed to book something, needed to pay something. I really can't remember, but it was something I needed to do.
Paying for my utilities that I need to shower, or try out this new Python library, right?
Yeah, so obviously I tried out the new Python library and thought, yeah, this is pretty good, pretty cool stuff.
And was this at the time when you had already been doing less and less Pandas? Like, I can imagine there's this point in time where you formally put the flag into the sand and say, like, I'm no longer a maintainer. Like, was this after the your period, or?
Oh no, this is when it went back up again, because by then I'd started working at QuantSight Labs, and at the time I was even spending about half my week on Pandas.
We should maybe explain that actually. So QuantSight Labs is an interesting company in that sense, because not a whole lot of companies pay their employees to work on open source. So maybe could you elaborate on that?
Sure thing. So QuantSight Labs is the open source part of a company called Quantsight, which does consulting, training, generally try to regard themselves as the experts in open source, which I think is pretty fair. Like the person who created NumPy is the CEO. Like the number of colleagues I have who are maintainers of major libraries is pretty high.
Rolf Gommers is a name that that rings a bell. He's also quite involved, I think it's fair to say. Like there are like pretty strong resumes in that group. That's certainly true.
In the open source field, yeah. There's a few open source celebrities. The labs part is the one that deals with things which directly go to open source. So not doing open source for a client, but usually things that just go out into the open source ecosystem. In a lot of my work there was funded by a NASA grant that was for Pandas, NumPy, Matplotlib, and Scikit-learn. So yeah, by then I was already working, I was getting paid to do Pandas. And at that time I was realizing that I probably shouldn't be doing this as a hobby as well. So trying to take a step back from doing it outside of work. So of course, what do I do outside of work? And I'm procrastinating on some life admin. I say, well, let's try out some other open source project. Let's try out this Polus that I've seen people write good things about, including yourself. Your blog post, The Expressions API is Amazing, was one of the first ways that I came across it. And I thought, well, Vincent likes it. There must be something to it.
I really did like, and I still really do. But you mentioned something interesting there. So, because you were saying you were doing less Pandas in your own, like in your weekends, so to say. Did the employment at Quantsight help there? Because I can imagine if you can tell yourself, like, hey, I do Pandas for work, that means I don't do Pandas anymore on the weekend. Like, is that like a mental shift that also really helps to say no to some issues?
Oh, yeah, completely, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine it being a bit of a game changer. Like, if you do open source for your work, it becomes your work and not your hobby anymore. So that kind of gives you more control over your hobby, I would say.
Yeah, I'm really grateful to Quantsight for this. I think they do a lot of good in the open source ecosystem. And I think this is also an opportunity for lots of companies. Like, it's a relatively underfunded space. And if you want to talk about the marginal difference you can make, then funding to someone to work on a project that you care about can really make a difference.
And there's also the thing of like, hey, there is this core library that we all kind of depend on. Let's say it's NumPy, let's say it's Pandas or whatever. Let's have people be well-fed and let's give them like plenty of sleep. And then when they're fit, let's have them work there. Like maybe weekends when people are tired or supposed to be resting, maybe that's not the most opportune time for critical software to be written. Also something about that, I think, makes it interesting to think about like, hey, maybe people should just be employed to work on open source because it's better that way.
I'm hoping that it becomes more common in the future.
I can definitely imagine it's a bit tricky though, but okay, we're getting closer towards Polus because I think I was definitely early when it came to discovering Polars. And I remember I implemented the pipe method. Like that was missing from Polars when I started playing with it. And I just saw Richie present his like COVID project here and there. And I thought it was like, and I thought it was pretty cool and interesting. But at some point I kind of figured, you know, it's also good to rethink the data frame API once in a while. And I was a little bit tired of the way Pandas did it. Like I do have good memories of the way R did it. And at some point I looked at Polars and I started thinking like, this is a lot more like R in a lot of ways. Like this is kind of like how R people like to do data frame stuff. But to me, the whole performance was almost like secondary. Like I really care more about having the great API. And that's also why I figured like, hey, Richie, if you'll have me, I'll gladly write a blog post on your blog because it feels like that's a point that people are sort of missing out on. Everyone was focusing a lot on the benchmarks, which I get. But the real game changer to me, at least, was just very nice API for data frames. That was kind of the main missing bit. But okay, like you noticed the blog post, and then at some point you started thinking like, okay, this is weekend time, only if I think it's fun. And you thought playing around with Polars was fun. And like, would you describe it as a magical moment? Or like, was it a moment that had a lot of impression for you? Or was it like a small little snowball that kept on rolling at some point?
Probably a bit more of the latter. Like it certainly felt quite liberating. But what happened was that I tried using it. I thought it looked good. I mean, like you, I'm a huge fan of the API. Maybe we'll talk later about narwhals, but there's a reason why I've chosen the Polus API for narwhals to be modeled after. That I've modeled narwhals after the Polus API. Anyway, so trying to use Polus, I noticed a little bug whereby the time unit wasn't getting passed down somewhere. And I thought, well, I think by then I'd kind of got an intuition for when a bug feels, you know, feels approachable compared to when it's going to be impossible. And even though I'd never looked at the Polos code base and didn't know Rust, I was like, well, this feels like it's probably not too difficult to take a look at the code base and understand where it is.
That might also be good to mention to some listeners. Like Polars, in the end, one of the reasons why it's fast is because it's written in Rust. That's also interesting because it sometimes also means that if you want to make a contribution for a Python library, you have to make a Rust PR. Like that is a bit intimidating to some people, which we should acknowledge. But I think you saw this as a challenge then. Like you basically thought like, hey, even though Rust is kind of new to me, maybe this is a problem that's small enough that I can teach myself just enough Rust to make a dent in this issue. That was kind of your approach.
That is exactly it. I mean, one of the first things that surprised me was that I could understand what the functions inside Polars were meant to do. Like not saying I could understand everything, not saying I could understand all of the Rust shenanigans, but usually I found that if I looked at a function, I could understand the intention behind it. And then you just need to look through all of the details of it, add a million debug statements. Eventually you understand where the fix needs to happen. And I cannot say the same about a lot of the Python functions that I was used to looking at inside of Pandas. And I think one reason for that is that Rust is just a lot harder to program with. So Rust is a lot pickier. It's a lot harder to get it to compile, whereas Python will accept almost anything. And so as a programmer, you're much more likely to introduce hacks in a Python codebase than you are in a Rust codebase. And even though Rust has a steep learning curve, in terms of accessibility, I think the Polars codebase is really nice to work with. That was one of the first things that really surprised me. Another thing that surprised me was just how friendly and fast Richie was at merging pull requests and providing feedback. We kind of had a bit of a... Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really quick, but we had a kind of like, I'll help you, you help me kind of thing, in that most of my early contributions were around date times and time zones and date time parsing. And he said that he just hated working with that stuff. And I was like, okay, well, I've done a bunch of this stuff in Pandas. I know a thing or two about how it's meant to work.
But let's be honest, Marco. You wake up one day, the sun is shining, and someone says, oh, I want to dive into the shenanigans of time zone in data structures. Said no one ever. If you think about like all the little details in daytime land, I can't imagine Ricky's approach of like, I just want to make my library faster. Why do I have to worry about these time zones?
It was a bit like that. Yeah, he just didn't want to have to think about this nonsense. And I was like, well, I don't know Rust, but I've got some experience working on this particular little niche from my time in Pandas. So, okay. I'll help you out with your time zones, and you help me out with the Rust. And I think it ended up being mutually beneficial.
I can imagine this actually quite well, because and I cannot speak on behalf of Richie, the main maintainer of Polars, but what I can, time zones and time in general and leap years and February 29th, like there's all sorts of these like little things that could go wrong once you go into time zone country, and especially if you're dealing with different timestamps from different time zones. And I can definitely also imagine it's one of those problems where, or areas, I should say, you don't exactly know what the problem is unless you've been deeply exposed to the issues. And I can definitely imagine that your experience in Pandas here totally, totally helps. So that, like, if I were Richie, I would totally see that as a boon. I can definitely imagine that.
Maybe. Yeah, I'd like to think that he saw it as a positive. Either way, he was very welcoming and friendly.
Sure. Oh, okay, that makes sense. I mean, he's also eager to build like a little community around the project, of course. So that all makes sense. But then at some point, you know, what's interesting about you then, I suppose, is when I talk about an open source project, one thing I always try to figure out is like, why does it make sense that a person like person X ends up making project Y? And we're going to pivot to that now. We're going to be talking about this library called Narwhals. And one thing that from this history book I am reading, you had a lot of experience with Pandas and a lot of experience with Polars at some point. And because you were very experienced in both, I can also imagine you had a perspective. Because are there a lot of people from the Pandas main core maintainer group that ended up doing Polar stuff? I think might not be. I don't know how big the overlap is, just out of curiosity.
I think I'm the only person regularly involved in both.
Okay.
No, there are some people who have made one-off contributions.
Okay. Now, but then it does make sense that a project like Narwhals is made by someone like you. Like that is an interesting conclusion then. And maybe this would also be a great point in time to explain to people what Narwhals is and what it does.
Sure thing. Yeah, there's lots to talk about here. Narwhals is a lightweight compatibility layer between data frame libraries. So the idea is to make something available for primarily for library maintainers, such that they can define the data frame logic of their library, such that their library can accept any major data frame library. The computation can all happen natively. And as far as their users is concerned, it's just their data frame library that's being used. You said that it seemed that I was the right person to do it, and I don't know for certain that that's a fact, but I did feel like, well, I do have a somewhat unique position whereby it makes sense that I at least try to do it. So I think open source, it's often, as well as being a technical challenge, it's a social challenge as well. When people open pull requests, the maintainer often isn't just looking at your code. They're often also just taking a look at your profile, seeing who are you, what else have you done. It kind of gives you a bit of an indication of how to interact with the person and how, what kind of feedback, what to tolerate.
Well, and also, as a maintainer, you also want to know the application a bit. So then it makes sense to check, this is being used in aviation or in oil and gas or in financial land. Like, having that extra bit of context is usually very useful. If only that, right? Like that, there's a reason why I would kind of explore the person who's making the issue or pull request.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in the end, I think that on the technical side, I don't think Narwhals is a particularly advanced project. Like it's all just Python. It's all just like mapping syntaxes between data frame libraries. The part of translating the Polar syntax to pandas takes a bit of effort, but it's not that huge. I'll be giving a talk later this year at PyData Amsterdam explaining how to make sense of Polar's expressions when you're used to pandas. But it's really not as hard as it might look initially before you've tried to do it. On the social side, though, I do think that me being involved in it really helped. So my initial assumption was that I'd put out Narwhals, I might have to wait like 12 months, and then maybe some minor library might try to use it for something. It kind of surprised me how things went. Like within a few months, you were open to using it in your project scikit-lego.
Well, maybe we should draw the timeline on this one, because I do agree a lot of things happened pretty quickly. So I guess I knew that you were working on this thing called Narwhals, and I figured, hey, that might be something interesting to do in a live stream, because I do that on behalf of my employer. That's my introduction to Narwhals, by the way. I knew you were working on it. And what I thought was interesting is, my conclusion to the library was, this is a library that the end user should never use. This is a library for maintainers. And that's like on its own pretty unique, but it's also kind of useful because I do a lot of stuff in data science. Boy, are there a lot of moments when they're like, should I use pandas or should I use polars? And you kind of want to have an API that just allows both, or maybe other data frames as well. I think Dask is on your roadmap. But that was my perspective. I was just kind of interested in it. So then I did a live stream. And my impression is that live stream was watched by a few people, one of which was the other maintainer of this project called scikit-lego. I believe you two got talking. And then Francesco came up to me and said, wouldn't it be fun to see if we could change everything in scikit-lego, the library that I have maintained, to see if we don't have to worry about pandas or polars anymore by using this Narwhals trick? And, you know, I basically told him, like, hey, I have a kid. I can't lead this effort. But Francesco, if you feel like doing it, that's great. I will definitely review. But, like, then scikit-lego could then be a test bed for this idea. Like, that was kind of the way we approached it. And I think this was within 2 months of you starting the project, something like that.
Something like that. But something I remember you saying, maybe not publicly, but something I do remember you saying this, that you said, Marco, I know your resume. Like,
yeah.
The things that I'd done, things that I'd been involved in, and you were like, yeah, I think we can trust this, we can try it out. And then also you said, like, scikit-lego, it's a bit of an experimental library, so it's not like it's foundational infrastructure.
It's not foundational infrastructure, and if it helps people and if it's fun for the maintainers, like, that last part is important to me. But then I think it's fine. Like, and Francesco was really into it, so okay, it's fun to maintain. People, and also, like, maybe we will learn some lessons about, like, hey, when you try to interoperate polars and pandas, where do people hit their head? Like, there are things we might learn from the whole thing. But yeah, like, that was pretty well received and was also pretty quickly done. I think it took maybe 2 weeks for the whole thing, maybe?
Something like that, yeah. We ended up it became a bit of an addiction, and Francesco just dove headfirst into it.
He definitely did. I did remind him on occasion that it didn't have to be done tomorrow. Like, a week from now is also fine. My perspective as a maintainer is I think it should be fun, and I'm keen on introducing new ideas. I think for Francesco, it's also a great learning opportunity, and therefore he's probably also a little bit more eager. And also, I believe he doesn't have kids. Things like that at some point also really matter. But okay, we're 2 months in right now. Like, at some point, I recall, like, we made this thing in Scikit-Lego. It was a really cool demo. That also allowed you to write a blog post on the QuantSight blog, I think, because, you know, we had you had a very nice example of Scikit-Lego seems to benefit from it. I think we had like one bug a month later or something like that, but it was relatively painless. Like, we're like months later now and still no big issues came in. But then what happened? Like, I'm trying to paint the picture of the line here, but Scikit-Lego, that was kind of the first playground.
Yeah, exactly. And after that, yeah, my expectation was that we might look at other projects that are kind of the size of Scikit-Lego and see if they might be interested in trying this out as well. And then after a year or so, people can trust us enough that maybe we can suggest it to some bigger projects. What surprised me then was that I got tagged by a contributor in the Altair repository. So Altair is a visualization giant, and
I think it's Matplotlib and Altair. Those are the two big ones now, I think. Yeah,
yeah, I don't know. To be honest, I'm not a visualization expert, so I can't really comment on.
Let me put it this way: those are the two libraries that I use.
Okay, most.
And there's many others, and they're all great. Just to be clear on that one. But I will say Altair is definitely one of the bigger ones, and it is a really good one.
To be honest, I think it practically can be considered foundational infrastructure in the data ecosystem. Like,
oh yeah, these days for sure.
Yeah. So one of the contributors, who at the time wasn't yet a maintainer, but one of the contributors had suggested to use Narwhals in the project. And I was just there saying, yeah, okay, there's no way they're going to use this. And I just wrote to them, yeah, thanks for considering Narwhals. I think you might be better off just first making a separate code path for polars, a separate code path for pandas, seeing how far you get, and then later
you recommended them against using Narwhals.
I just thought, yeah, there's no way they're going to use this. Like, I was, and I really wanted them to actually have really good native support for polars, and I didn't want that Narwhals would get in the way of that.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, because one theme here, right, is, if a project like Altair, which let's consider that to be like core infrastructure, if they end up using Narwhals, a side effect of that is that Narwhals becomes critical infrastructure overnight as well, right? Because I'm mentioning this because we mentioned burnout before, like, you know, no pressure, but your hobby project is now critical infrastructure. Like, I can also imagine that like there's feelings about that as well.
That's one way to look at it. Yeah. So
I'm not trying to put pressure on you, but this is a voice that would definitely appear in my mind if this was happening. Right?
It's, yeah, definitely in my mind. Yeah, I can say quite a bit about that. Maybe before I do, just one thing on the process with Altair was that the maintainers said that they weren't too enthusiastic about having specialized code paths for each library.
Mm.
And they said, well, on the face of it, it looks like Narwhals is exactly the kind of abstraction layer we need. Maybe do you want to submit a pull request in which you show us how this could be used? And they said, like, the person who wrote it, he included a message that was something like, PS, I really enjoyed your talk at PyData Berlin. So going back to the social part about open source, like, in the end, if you know people, if you impress them in other ways, if they know your resume, it helps them to trust you.
And in particular, the PyData and SciPy conferences. I don't know what it is about those two, but those two tend to leave an impact, I've noticed. SciPy a little bit more for scientific, but PyData is a little bit more industry, is my impression. But those two, like all the open source maintainers, tend to have an eye on those talks, is my sort of impression. So just to briefly touch back on the topic of like core infrastructure, like if I were to imagine what might be big causes of burnout, it is that feeling of responsibility, I would imagine. And it's also partially why I think for Lego, I'm very principled, like, no, it should be fun. And if it's anything but that, then it's no longer interesting. And again, my attitude, we do have tests, so don't worry too much about it. But the responsibility aspect of it, I can imagine that also puts pressure.
Totally.
does that also mean that Narwhals is now less of a hobby project now because you have to take it serious? Like, what are your feelings about that?
So I certainly still want it to be fun. Like, I still give people GIFs whenever I approve a pull request, and we just generally try to keep it quite lighthearted.
Right. Okay. But and those are little things that do tend to help. Like pull requests. Yeah. There's also time for a little bit of laughter and fun. Not everything has to be super duper serious. Like that definitely adds a nice atmosphere. That definitely.
Yeah. But at the same time, we do need to be super serious about the responsibility that we're taking on. Like, we're promising a lot to the ecosystem. It's very difficult to gain people's trust, and I think it's extremely easy to lose it. Like, I think it just takes one regression, and it's like, in the end, what we're competing with is people having a separate file with a bunch of if-then statements. It can't be that hard to lose people's trust.
Well, I mean, so the thing is, I can imagine at least, right? If I think about scikit-lego, like, how would you have done it, Vincent? I mean, either each and every single one of these libraries would have their own little narwhals kind of sub-code base with helper files to sort of deal with this, or there would be like a quote-unquote a standard. And the interesting thing about standards is that they sometimes just pop up out of nowhere, like by coincidence, and sometimes they are planned ahead. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to get there. But it kind of feels like at this point, narwhals might become a standard kind of unplanned by accident very early.
I would like to see that happen. It wasn't the objective, but mm-hmm. I mean...
But what was the original objective? Because I can imagine part of the objective was, hey, if I just stick to the Polar's API, can I also get Pandas to work? Like, was that kind of the direction that you were going into first? Or
yeah, it just kind of seemed kind of fun. And Joris, who's one of the Pandas co-developers, he'd given a lightning talk at EuroSciPy. So for listeners who are unaware, lightning talks at conferences, they're just 5-minute presentations. People often just show quick, fun, experimental things that aren't necessarily meant to be taken too seriously. So he was showing how he could use the kind of Polar's expressions within Pandas. And
I mean, then again, some lightning talks also are just plain announcements of huge open source projects. I remember Jupyter was a lightning talk, like that announcement.
Really?
Yeah. Jupyter got announced as a lightning talk.
No way.
It was back in the day when we had IPython notebooks instead of Jupyter notebooks. And then the whole point with the Jupyter effort was also to maybe have multiple languages like Julia, Python, and R, Jupyter. But the first demo and announcement of it was a lightning talk, I believe, at PyCon.
Well, that's mad. Anyway, so yeah, Narwhals also owes its origin to a lightning talk. Not my lightning talk, Joris's lightning talk. But I thought, wow, that looks pretty neat. Like, let's see how far we can take this. And, you know, one thing leads to another, start getting contributions, things start happening. At the time, you know, like being really involved in Polar's maintenance, I could see Polar's growing. But the number one criticism that I always saw people give of Polar's was that it lacked integrations that Pandas had. Like, so many libraries support Pandas, but they don't support Polar's. And I was like, okay, well, surely there's got to be something we can do to address this.
I remember when I made my first Polar's course, boy, like a couple of years ago, I saw that complaint kind of coming. And I basically told folks, like, you know, you can always do two Pandas at the end, and then it will always work with whatever library. But if everything before that you wish to do in a sort of nice API, this is the way you can kind of do it. So to me, it's always kind of felt like you can complain about that last verb. You could. But as a library maintainer, it's a slightly different story.
Yeah, definitely. But also as a user, like we saw in scikit-lego, that you're doing feature engineering there. And doing feature engineering natively in Polar's can be hundreds of times faster than having to do two Pandas and then convert back.
Yeah, that is true. So definitely the performance argument is there. But then, and you do take a performance, that is the alternatives. Okay, so Pandas goes in. Oh, let's convert that to Polar's and then back again. Like, that's also a performance hit right there, especially if it could have been lazy, let's say.
Exactly. Yeah. So then on the core infrastructure part, maybe there's a couple of things that I wanted to mention in terms of how things have changed. So yeah, our test suite has got a bit longer because now we test downstream for Altair and scikit-lego. Check that we're not breaking stuff for you.
Gesundheit. So scikit-lego is part of the testing framework inside of Narwhals now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we run a downstream test on scikit-lego to check that any new commit doesn't break your test suite. It doesn't mean it's not going to introduce regressions because there might be things not covered by tests. But
sure.
I think this is the minimum we can do, really.
The thing, I did not know that you did this with my little open source project, is what I'm trying to say. Okay, so I can definitely imagine, like, what do you do? You cover your ground a bit more, so more tests, that makes sense. And any other, like, sort of more human changes then? Because, I mean, tests are pretty mechanical.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One is releases. Like, we do releases really frequently. And, I mean, it's just a pure Python project. It's really easy to do releases, and I want the release process to be as streamlined as possible. So I think if something's painful, do it often. You know, we're trying to aim for that. But yeah, now I always do releases in the morning, just in case anything comes up, I can be awake to fix it.
Oh, that's clever, actually. That makes sense. I mean, then the next release will have to wait until the next morning after, but I do kind of, but I can imagine, again, coming back to the argument of maybe open source people should not work nights and weekends. Also relates to stuff like this. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, at this point in time, yeah, like if some major regression was reported, I think I would just drop everything and try to fix it. But ideally, I don't want to be doing that in the middle of the night compared to, let's say, in the middle of the afternoon.
And I'm making an assumption here, but I'm assuming now that also because it's on the quant side blog and stuff, like I'm assuming your employer also gives you some time to work on this effort, I suppose, right?
So up until recently, I was given some interns to work with on it.
Okay.
Who were really helpful. Like, yeah, they did. Like now in the documentation, every single example, it's got, every single function has got an example in the docs. I think that's just so important for
users. Helps a lot.
But against my expectations, Nawals has become a lot bigger than any of us were initially expecting. So maybe now we can renew conversations about continuing.
Right. So it's mainly because I can imagine Scikit-Lego is not critical infrastructure, but the moment that critical infrastructure projects do pop around and sort of say like, hey, we're going to use it, then the conversation of responsibility and also planning there immediately changes, I suppose. Like that's a phase it's in.
I think so, yeah. We haven't formally figured something out, but I think now it's going to be a lot easier.
Interesting.
Compared to like, hey, here's my weekend project, give me money.
Yeah.
That doesn't go down well.
You might get a few weird glances when you do that. Okay. So, and when you think about sort of the more human thing, I can also imagine like, hey, how you interact with collaborators. And like one thing I can imagine, especially when we're talking interns, if it's critical infrastructure, it's also going to be harder for someone that's a bit more junior on the spectrum of their career to sort of pitch in as well, right? Like I can also imagine that has all sorts of influence on how it's like to maintain such a thing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, my experience with interns is that what works is really clearly defined tasks with examples. Mm. And if you do that, then you can get a lot out of them. And then towards the end of their internship, or at least in the second half, you try to get a bit more input out of them once they're already kind of familiar with how things work. If you expect them to work too independently from the start, it doesn't go too well.
Yeah, and it helps to have like a safe ground where they both get, where everyone is just productive, basically. And then from there, you can sort of move on to more complex things. Makes sense.
You definitely need to get a good positive feedback at the beginning and get that fairly consistently before you've even got the courage to try to take on more complicated things. But you were asking about merge commits. So originally, I was just so happy when anyone would make a pull request that I just had this internal rule of if anyone is able to independently make a pull request and I think it's ready without me having had to help them, then okay, that's it. I add you to the Narwhals dev team. You can merge other people's pull requests. You can approve them. And that worked really well. Like, you know, it encourages people, gives people a bit of responsibility. And the stakes at the time were really low. Like, realistically, what's the worst thing that can happen? Because,
I mean, Scikit-Lego might go down, but on a larger scheme of things, it's not even that's different than, oh, this library that really has millions of users. That is a very different ballgame.
But even with Scikit-Lego, like, that wouldn't have happened because all changes had to be made through pull requests. So, like, even if somebody, like, I would have had to get two people to coordinate on some malicious pull request, and then one person approves the other and merges it, and then they still didn't have permission to make releases. So, like, realistically,
that is a very important distinction. Merge request does not imply release permissions. That is a difference. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So, but yeah, I mean, just in terms of letting people merge a pull request, like, I think that's fairly realistically. Not much can go wrong.
It's also a trust thing. And in the end, we're probably all mature adults in a room. We just have small disagreements on small things. And the big picture thing is, oh, this is simple, merge. Oh, it's complex. Well, not merge. Let's talk first. It's pretty easy for the culture to have that vibe pretty early on. It's not the hardest thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, now that the project's growing, I don't think we can be quite so liberal with just giving away rights.
Yeah, I'm a recommend against that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But certainly, like at the beginning, it felt like if someone was contributing to a small project, it's because they're genuinely interested in it.
So a few things that are interesting here, though. I mean, so you say in the beginning, but that beginning was only a span of 4 months. Yeah. Right, we're talking as if the project is a few years old, but it's actually still pretty young if you think about it. So that's like an interesting observation already. I think it's pretty rare to see a project have this much growth and an adoption so early. Like usually it does take a year, like usually. But then I start wondering, like, why might that be? And I do observe that you are solving a problem that a lot of libraries do face.
Yeah,
data frames are somewhat ubiquitous, and a lot of it really is polars or pandas, and there hasn't been a unifying framework for that for a while, and that puts a lot of pressure on maintainers because suddenly you have more than one data frame to worry about.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of luck then, like that we just happened to be in the right place at the right time. It's also just that polars is really taking off. I think if we tried to make novels 2 years ago, then nobody would have cared for us because at the time, nobody would have thought it true. Worthwhile to try to support multiple data frame libraries.
So I just want to make a very funny analogy. So the first person I interviewed for this podcast, Trevor, he has this project called AnyWidget. And Altair is also a user of AnyWidget now. AnyWidget is basically this way to make Jupyter widgets work in any notebook. So not just Jupyter, but it also makes them available in Colab or in the Jupyter thing inside of VS Code and you name it. And you can imagine that a lot of these visualization widget libraries, they all have this issue of, oh man, now I got to learn Colab in order to get my thing to work there. And oh man, now I got to learn this other weird voodoo that's called VS Code. And I'm sure all the APIs are fine, but like you have to learn this other thing in order to just maintain the little widget. And AnyWidget solved that problem. So, and also AnyWidget, it's not a thing that an end user would use. It is something a maintainer would use. And you have like, and that's so interesting with your thing. There's a lot of similarities there. And I can imagine like the adoption is pretty high because it solves a problem for the maintainer. It makes a headache go away.
Interesting, yeah. So basically, if you invite someone on your podcast, then that causes their project to get adopted by Altair.
To be clear, just before the podcast with Trevor, Altair already announced that they were going to add support. And also just before this one, I think Altair also added support. So it's not... the causal relationship works the other way. But
I think in both cases, you'd invited the person.
Yeah, true. Already. But like the announcement for Altair was already made before. Like I don't want to take credit for that. I do appreciate the joke, though. No, but I do think that. But the reason why I like talking about this sort of stuff in this podcast is because it is sometimes a chaotic mix on how something is created in open source land. But sometimes, if you just plot the dots and sort of see the red line through the history book, some of it also makes sense. Part of it is the timing. Part of it is, hey, do we have a person who has the right background to actually make this thing work? But another part of it is, hey, is this just really solving a problem a bunch of people have? Because if you have all three, it spreads like wildfire. That's a theory I've got, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's early days. I don't know if it will spread like wildfire.
Well, right, sure. But the idea will spread. Let me put it this way. Sometimes an idea doesn't get spread, and that's also a bad thing. Sometimes there's good ideas that do need to be spread around a bit.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I'd like to think that we're at a point where if we play the cards right, then maybe we can get a further adoption and have a significant impact on the ecosystem. At the end, that's what we're trying to enable, really. Like, I'm more interested in giving a better experience to users trying to use data frame libraries other than pandas.
The goal is not to use narwhals. The goal is to just have less headaches.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, in the end, if people want to solve this problem without narwhals, that's, I'm still happy, like, as long as the problem gets solved.
Yeah. That makes sense. I guess, we have a little bit of time left, not too much, but there's a few, takes I'm just kind of interested in. Because you made a bit of a pivot, I think. Like, you were a practitioner before, and now you are a bit more of a tool maker. And it's also a natural transition. I think it's better to be a user of a tool before you start making some yourself. But I can also imagine that life is just a little bit different. Like, your perspective is a bit different, your concerns, your day-to-day is a bit different. If you were to sort of look back and sort of reflect, like, what do you think is the main difference if you're more of a user of a tool as opposed to a maintainer of one?
Yeah, your considerations change, certainly. Like, I think it's interesting to see how people's first contributions differ from their, let's say, 100th contribution.
Like, oh, yeah.
If you see just a casual user submit a fix in a tool, it's usually because they're facing some problem with the tool. There's maybe some assertion, I don't know, there's some expectation somewhere in the code base, and if they just put an if-then statement around it, then their problem goes away. And so they submit that as a fix. They say, look, this solves my problem, please merge it. But as a maintainer of the tool, if you keep accepting patches like that, then you end up with a big spaghettified mess that's impossible to reason about, a big house of cards. So your perspective certainly changes in that respect. Like, you start being really skeptical of pull requests that contain if-then statements, and you're like, wait, what's the bigger picture? Let's take a step back.
Yeah, as a tool user, you are usually focusing on a very specific problem, and you don't have to worry about the general sort of game, so to say. And I can also imagine, like, oh, for my specific thing, I just need an if statement, done, and I can move on. But for a library maintainer, that's a very different consideration.
Yeah, exactly. And you also kind of aim to have it be maintainable by other people. And so if you've got too many if-then statements, then it can usually only fit inside one person's brain if they've been looking at that code base that particular day.
Yeah, exactly. Like, a year from now, that might also just be a headache.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Now, I can also imagine... But I can also imagine that as a maintainer, some of the magic also kind of goes away. Like, I do remember back in the day, like, oh, a pip install, and oh, I've got this thing called pandas. How does the internal work? Well, I don't care. I just need to add a column to a table. Like, I can also imagine as a maintainer, it can also be very hard to know what it's like not to know your tool, if that makes sense.
Well, I think you suddenly forget what it's like for people to not know your tool, which is why documentation written by longtime maintainers is often not the best, to be completely honest.
Like,
I think documentation improvements often come better from power users than from people who have been working too heavily with the internals for a long time. But on the other side, as a maintainer, you're still using a lot of tools yourself, which you don't understand. So that feeling doesn't go away.
Nah, true. Like, if you're using PyTest or Flake, there's implementation details there that are hidden from you, and that's a good thing. Like, if you had to understand how an engine works in order to drive a car, the cars would be way less productive.
Yeah. Coincidentally, one of my early open source contributions was also in PyTest. So you know how when you're running your test suite, that when as long as tests are passing, it's all green dots. And then you've got like a percentage, like it shows you like 33%, 66%, and so on. So at the beginning, it was all like just green dots. And then at some point, they would turn into red dots. And
if there's a failure,
exactly. So my contribution was, and this is like probably the only aesthetic contribution I've ever made in open source, was that the percentages would also get, like, their color would match that of the dots. So like the percentage would be green while your tests are passing, and then it turns orange or red according to when you've got warnings or failures.
This was, I mean, I can't even remember a time when this wasn't the case, but yeah, like that's definitely like an inconsistency. if the color of the percentage doesn't up, solid implementation thing there. I guess I've got like two questions to ask still. Like, one, because I do think it's nice that people talk about it. Given that you now have a project that seems to be going places, is it still a hobby project of yours, or is it now also becoming a cause of stress? Like, I can imagine that that's also like an internal thing that you're trying to, I don't know if you're grappling with it, if that's the right word, but I can imagine it being a theme at least, as you're trying to figure out like, hey, what should we do with this?
It's not stressing me out yet. At the moment, it's still like, we're still really in the euphoric, this is amazing stage of it.
The honeymoon phase of the open source project.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've not really defined the governance too well. At the moment, I'm kind of informally acting as BDFL. That's mm-hmm. been a benevolent dictator for life for listeners who might not be aware, not be familiar with the acronym. But I'd like to set up some governance structure so that if the project does really end up going places, then it can outlive me.
Yeah, or at least you should be able to go on a holiday without feeling guilty or something like that, right? Like that's kind of the battle plan at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Makes sense. And that's a hard thing. Like a lot of open source maintainers, they do mention to me that there's this burden of responsibility once something becomes pretty popular, and that it might slow the project down a bit, but it might also introduce a whole lot of stress. So if you're still in the honeymoon phase, I would definitely commend you to enjoy it. and if the project goes somewhere, that's also fun, of course, but that's okay. Cool theme. I guess like a final question that I'm always kind of curious about, like, are there any shout outs to what you believe are underappreciated pieces of work that people might need to pay a bit more attention to? I mean, we've been talking about this project that people should never use directly. Maintainers should, but like, are there pieces of work or tools that you do think like, hey, you know, if you're a practitioner or even a maintainer, there's just a few things that I would pay more attention to in this day and age?
Right. So I definitely don't think that UV is underappreciated. It's getting a lot of attention these days. Mm-hmm. But there's one feature of UV which is underappreciated, and that's just how kind its error messages are. Like yesterday, I did pip install requirements.txt, and this pop-up came up saying, we noticed you typed pip install requirements. Did you mean -r requirements? And I typed y for yes, and then it just treated it as if I'd done
So you didn't have to go through the manual effort of retyping UV pip install. Yeah,
that was just such a nice thing. And it's not to do with how fast it is. Like, it's just, maybe it's because it's written in Rust, and Rust has really nice error messages. And so then when you write error messages yourself, you think to yourself, well, maybe we should make a kind of rustier error message. But I do kind of thing.
I do fundamentally agree that there's a small art form in making the right error message, because you also have to try to imagine who is going to read this. But when it's done well, it is amazing. Step one is to clearly explain to the user what has gone wrong. And step two is automatically being able to fix it with minimal effort for the user, which is exactly what happened here.
I mean, we've been doing a bunch of that in Polos as well, where like the error message says something. And then below the error message, we have like hint, perhaps. If you were doing this, perhaps you should do this instead. Not nearly as much as there should be, but as a suggestion to listeners, if you're interested in contributing to open source, then the usual advice you'd receive is to look for good first issue, these kinds of labels. To be honest, I'm not sure I recommend that advice. I recommend just using the tool. And then when you come across something that's not the way it should be, like an unclear error message, then, well, that's your good first issue.
Yeah, and often that's docs, sometimes that's error messages, but it's you are a real user trying to learn a tool. Anything that you can do to make that better for you in the moment will also help do it for someone else. That is also definitely the right vibe. Cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see how what happens to narwhals. It's from the perspective of a little weird package called scikit-lego, it's been fun to see how my collaborations seem to have helped things move forward. I'm also speaking on behalf of Francesco on that one, but I also think it's cool to have a podcast about a tool that people should never directly use, like something, because a lot of the tools and software, I mean, 99% of it is hidden. Like, if I think about all the stuff the scikit-learn does under the hood for you, the whole point is that you don't have to know how an engine works in order to drive a car. And something like that is also happening with narwhals here. So it'll be fun to see.
Yeah, we'll see about that. I mean, the original objective was that it would just be a tool for library maintainers. I am slightly starting to be more open to the fact that it could be useful to end users.
Yeah, so we're kind of at time, so I feel like I should admit going into a deep dive on that one. But yeah, no, as with many things, time will tell. But until then, Marco, thanks for being on. If people want to find you, know more about you, I guess GitHub is a place if people want to talk about narwhals, but you still exist on Twitter as well, I think.
You can follow me on GitHub, yes. I'm not on Twitter. I am on Mastodon, on Fastodon.
That's the one.
And I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Ah, that's right. So I remember you tweeting about that UV thing, but it wasn't a tweet. It was an in-link or something. But yeah, cool. And I will also see you at PyData Amsterdam. If people are going to PyData Amsterdam, definitely go talk to me and Marco. Once again, thanks for being here. And yeah, see you all in the next one.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sample Space and also by making it to the end. As always, we will gladly take suggestions for people that we will interview next. And if you like what we have to show here, I also hope that you will check out our YouTube channel. We do a fair bunch of educational content, but you'll also be able to find these podcasts there as well. Once again, thanks for listening. See you in the next episode.